From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's to the best of our knowledge. This hour, shame.
He knew both the art of shame and shamelessness.
Shame.
But we can only destroy one person a night.
Shame.
And he was actually able to show that these mimes led to a decrease in fatalities.
I suddenly feel with social media like I'm tiptoeing around an unpredictable, angry, unbalanced parent who might strike out at any moment.
Same, 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 same.
I'm Anne Strainchamps, and as you've probably figured out by now, our topic today is shame. We all have secret, painful memories of being shamed, getting beat up in sixth grade, laughed at on the playground, saying something unforgettably stupid. But what if your humiliation is so public, it feels like everyone on the planet knows? What if you've been savaged on Twitter, mocked and humiliated online? What if you feel like Monica Lewinsky?
Anyone who is suffering from shame and public humiliation needs to know one thing. You can survive it. I know it's hard. It may not be painless, quick, or easy, but you can insist on a different ending to your story. Have compassion for yourself. We all deserve compassion. And to live both online and off in a more compassionate world. Thank you for listening.
17 years after her relationship with then-President Bill Clinton destroyed her reputation, Monica Lewinsky gave a TED Talk that's been seen more than 3 million times. Her message is that public shaming is a blood sport, and it has to stop. And you know what? She's right, because something about the anonymity of social media has people who probably seem perfectly nice in person posting vicious, scathing, humiliating comments online. Think of Gamergate or what happened to the new host of The Daily Show. No one's safe. So what's going on? John Ronson lays out some ideas in a new book called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. Doug Gordon sat down to talk with him.
John, a lot of the public shaming these days is taking place online, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, some people have criticized my book, have said this isn't such a great revelation. People shaming other people is just a part of life. But really, things have changed as a result of social media. I think partly as a result of the technology of social media, how Twitter is set up, that you surround yourself with people who feel the same way that you do. You surround yourself with like-minded people. And on a good day, that's a truly wonderful, revolutionary thing about Twitter, that if you're having a really bad time in your actual life, you can go on to Twitter and you're immediately surrounded with funny, eloquent, like-minded people, strangers. But when we're tearing somebody apart, we're all doing it, and there's nobody in our circle telling us to stop.
Yeah, there's this whole pack mentality of people. It's kind of like a pack of hyenas. Everyone piles on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that began to interest me so much. I suppose because, you know, I've spent 30 years journeying into these kind of strange corners of power and absurdity and abuse of power and people going crazy inside powerful elites. I mean, that's what kind of all my books are about, the psychopath test and them and the many state goats. And suddenly I thought, oh, my God, it's us now. We are the powerful, crazy, absurd people. And I've got to journey into this world and meet these victims, these people who are hiding away, having been ruined at our hands, and also those of us who were doing the ruining, you know, what's going on. So I just wanted to go on a journey to try and make sense of that.
And one of these people who is hiding away is Jonah Lehrer, who became very shameworthy after it was discovered that he'd invented some Bob Dylan quotes for a book of his called Imagine, How Creativity Works. And there was also the fact that he'd self-plagiarized several blog posts that he'd written for The New Yorker. What did he tell you during that hike and the other times you talked to him? What surprising things did he tell you, or what did he tell you about why he did it?
It was a mixture of insecurity and ambition. He felt like a fad. He felt like he was going to burn brightly and then fizzle out, which indeed is what happened, but at his own making, not at the market's making. He took on way too much work. He wasn't turning anything down because he felt like a fad and because he was ambitious. And it just became easy, you know. And then you'd forget, he would forget that the fake Bob Dylan quotes were in his book proposal and then they were in his book. And I said, forget. And he said, well, forget gets me off the hook too easily. He said, I didn't want to remember. It read well, so why check? Mm-hmm. But then the worst thing, well, I mean, if this wasn't bad enough, the man who discovered Jonah's deceptions, Michael Moynihan, who's a Dylanologist and a journalist and a blogger, because he was reading Jonah's new book and reading these Bob Dylan quotes. Like at one point, Bob Dylan says that creativity is a hard thing to describe. It's just the sense that you've got something to say. And as Michael read that, he thought, that doesn't sound like Bob Dylan. You know, in the mid-60s, Bob Dylan was just a nightmare to be interviewed. You know, he was never that helpful.
No, he's kind of like the opposite of you, whereas you're a dream.
Yeah,
interview.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But, thank you.
thank you.
Oh, no, creativity is just a hard thing to discover. That's my Bob Dylan impression.
Yeah, that's good.
Thank you. And in fact, if that quote sounded like anybody, it sounded like Jonah Lehrer. So Michael contacted Jonah Lehrer and Jonah made the terrible, the very human but very ridiculous mistake of effectively saying to Michael, my quotes are accurate, it's history that's wrong. Hmm. And then, but Michael knew that was a lie.
Yeah, and he did the legwork to prove that it was. Jonah Lehrer made this public apology at a Knight Foundation lunch in Miami. Can you tell me about that?
When we finished our hike and Jonah was just like, don't want to be in your book, I don't want to be in your book. At the end of our hike, he just completely took me by surprise by saying, I'm going to make a public apology next week. And he said, could I read his speech? So I read his speech back on the plane and it was an apology speech like no other. Jonah Lehrer was trying to explain his flaws, his personality flaws, within the context of neuroscience. So it was like a Jonah Lehrer speech about why Jonah Lehrer screwed up.
In the past, I have quoted a line from the physicist Niels Bohr. An expert, he said, is a man who has made all the mistakes which can be made in a very narrow field. Bohr is right. We learn how to get it right by getting it wrong again and again. But here's the crucial addendum, which I failed for so long to appreciate. Screwing up is not enough, because I certainly made lots of mistakes. I just tried not to pay attention to them. I did my best to look the other way.
So I take it didn't go over well?
No, it didn't. And the worst thing was that the Knight Foundation, who, you know, allowed him to give this apology speech and, in fact, paid him to give this apology speech.
$20,000, is that right?
$20,000. They had erected a giant screen live Twitter feed behind Jonah's head so anybody watching Jonah's apology could tweet their opinion of it in real time and it would appear right in Jonah's eyeline while he tried to apologize. So Jonah was on stage, the most important speech of his life, trying to apologize. And in giant letters on this live screen Twitter feed was coming up, Jonah Lehrer boring us into trying to forgive him. And Jonah Lehrer is tainted as a writer forever. And Jonah Lehrer is just a frigging sociopath and rantings of a deluded narcissist. This is while Jonah was in real time begging for mercy. Imagine that happening in an actual court. Imagine the murderer standing up and trying to apologise and the jury yelling out, bored. That was us. This was a moment when I think the idealism of Twitter clashed with the distorted reality of Twitter. Because I think the Knight Foundation set up this Twitter screen in a kind of moment of sort of idealism. We all thought Twitter is this incredible, wonderful thing. But the reality was by the time they had set up that screen, we had become devastatingly cruel.
Yeah. I wanted to also ask you about Justine Sacco. What did she do?
It happened shortly after the Jonah Lehrer thing, actually. And it just goes to show the kind of sliding scale of what we consider shameworthy. Because with Jonah, Jonah really had misused his privilege. Mm-hmm. You know, that's obviously, appropriately, the worst crime, the most shameworthy crime is a misuse of privilege. But then we just fell in love with getting people who had misused their privilege. And so we started taking, a lot of scalps, a lot of collateral damage. one of which was Justine Sacco, who is this New York City PR woman with 170 Twitter followers. She'd write little acerbic tweets and nobody ever replied to them. One of these tweets, just before getting on a plane to Cape Town, was, "Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white." So she pressed send and got no replies and felt that sad feeling we all feel when the internet doesn't congratulate us for being funny. Turned off her phone and slept on the plane and woke up 11 hours later and stretched, turned on her phone, and there was a text from somebody that she hadn't spoken to since high school that said, "I am so sorry to see what's happening to you right now." And Justine looked at it, baffled. And then another text from my best friend, "You need to call me now. You are the worldwide number one trending topic on Twitter."
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Imagine those words coming to you in a text when you've been asleep on a plane. So her tweet while she slept had gone around the world. One of her 170 Twitter followers had sent it to a journalist called Sam Biddle at Gawker, who retweeted it to his 15,000 followers, later told me that the feeling of doing that was delicious.
Mm.
I should point out at this stage that she was not intending to be racist. If she was, it would have been an unbelievably offensive thing to say. What she was trying to do was mock white privilege by doing a kind of exaggerated thing. You know, Randy Newman does it well in songs like Short People.
Yeah.
Short People Have Got No Reason to Live. I mean, it was just in the tradition of that. She just wasn't good at it. You know, what destroyed her was not being as good at it as Randy Newman.
Yes, exactly. And then she lost her job, didn't she? She paid like a real heavy price for that.
Yeah, but a lot worse than losing her job. She lost her sense of self. When I met her a couple of weeks later, she was waking up in the middle of the night, forgetting who she was, crying out her body weight, as she described it. The newspapers following her to the gym. Her family was furious with her. Trolls were saying, you know, let's rape her. Somebody HIV positive should rape her, and then we'll find out if her skin colour protects her from AIDS.
Oh, dear.
By the way, nobody went after that person because everyone was so excited about going after Justine Sacco. We can only destroy one person a night.
Yeah.
And then she upset not only the misogynistic trolls, but also the concerned liberals like us. People were tweeting, you know, in the light of this disgusting racist tweet, "I am donating to aid to Africa." So she really united a lot of disparate groups while she slept on the plane. And it just mangled her mental health. I mean, like Jonah, it's profoundly agonizing to be told by your community, get out. It's worse, actually. I would hazard, as awful as it is, to be attacked by trolls who use outrageous language, like death threats and rape threats, to be told by your entire community that you are worthless and you need to get out is worse because there's no support group there. There's nobody there to help you through.
You mentioned she lost her sense of self. Has she recovered it at all? How's she doing now?
Yeah, it took a year. I asked Sam Biddle, how do you think she is now? And he said, oh, I'm sure she's fine. And that made me smile because I really don't think Sam Biddle was being in any way unusually glib when he said that. I think we're all like that. We all want to destroy people but assume that they're fine because we don't want to feel bad. It took her a year to be okay. After a year, she got a new job. And then my book came out and then finally people were saying to her, I'm so sorry what we did to you. Actually, that's a lie. Nobody said that to her. What people said to her was, I am so sorry what those people did to you.
Hmm. They, not we. Yeah. I'd like to end by having you read the last few paragraphs of your book.
Okay. Soon after Justine Sacco's shaming, I was talking with a friend, a journalist, who told me that he had so many jokes, little observations, potentially risque thoughts that he wouldn't dare to post online anymore. I suddenly feel with social media like I'm tiptoeing around an unpredictable, angry, unbalanced parent who might strike out at any moment, he said. It's horrible. He didn't want me to name him, he said, in case it sparked something off. We see ourselves as nonconformist, but I think all of this is creating a more conformist, conservative age. Look, we're saying, we're normal. This is the average. We are defining the boundaries of normality by tearing apart the people outside of it.
That's John Ronson reading from his new book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. He talked with Doug Gordon. Coming up, there's a judge in Texas who's famous for meting out shame-based sentences. We'll meet a guy who served one of them. And also the upside of shame as a force for political change and social reform. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about shame in this hour. And so far, we've considered the soul-savaging, reputation-destroying aspects of public shaming. But can shame also be used for public good? There's a judge in Texas who's famous for his creative and very controversial shame-based sentences. To hear how they work, let's go back to Thanksgiving evening, 1996, Houston, Texas. That's the night 18-year-old Mike Hubachek slammed his Mustang convertible into a minivan belonging to the Davis family. The crash pretty much cut the van in half. It killed Barbara Davis's husband and their nanny, and it almost killed Barbara, too. Police later estimated that Hubachek had been driving nearly 100 miles an hour and that his blood alcohol content was twice the legal limit. So now, let's hear what Mike Hubachek remembers about that night.
On November 1996, I started drinking that afternoon around 3 o'clock. We were, I guess, having a party at the time. I was drinking often. Somewhere around 10 o'clock that night, I blacked out. Next thing I remember, I woke up in the hospital, and I was confused. I was scared. I didn't know what was going on. And one of the police officers at the time was there, said we need his blood, and I didn't want to give my blood. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know how I got there. And, you know, one of the officer looked at me and was like, you know, who gives an F about you? You just killed two people. Oh. And instantly, like, I went into shock. I saw, I don't know, like, everything was, like, white. I remember just crying. I remember just being in a lot of fear and not knowing what to do next. I was, you know, I guess, in a hospital bed, and my family was out of town at the time. They came back in the town. Some friends asked me, you know, that showed up to the hospital, they asked me, you know, what do you need? And I basically just wanted to get out of the hospital. I didn't know what was going on. I got released. I tried to go home. There was camera crews at my house. There was, you know, people there wanting to know, you know, what happened, and I still was in a daze. I ended up going to a hotel, and when I was in the hotel, I saw the evening news, and on the news, basically, my accident was on the lead story, and I just remember just crying and being scared and not, you know, being an 18-year-old kid and not knowing, you know, what to do next.
Yeah. And you still don't have any memory of that night itself, of the accident?
No, ma'am.
Yeah.
And it's something that I've tried remembering. I've tried, you know, forcing myself to remember. You know, I know my attorneys did accident recreations. They've done, you know, studies and tried to figure out, you know, everything that went on. There was witnesses to my direct right and left that never saw the vehicle either. And if at the time, I was drunk and speeding, so it was my fault.
Mm. So you wound up pleading no contest to intoxicated manslaughter, and you wound up sentenced to 10 years in prison. What were those first few days in prison like? Did you feel like you were still pretty much in shock?
Basically, at the time, I had Judge Poe. He was known as, you know, a strict judge. My case was on his docket, but his docket worked very quickly for cases in Texas.
And Judge Poe this is the guy, the Texas judge, who's famous for his creative sentences. Like, there was a teenager who stole a Nintendo game. His sentence was he was forced to ring bells for the Salvation Army. There was a guy who stole guns from the actor Clayton Moore. The guy who played the Lone Ranger on TV. He was sentenced to spend 600 hours cleaning the Houston Police Department stables. So Judge Poe wound up giving you one of his quote-unquote creative, shame-based solutions. What all did he tell you you had to do?
I had to serve the 6 months at TDC. And when I got out of there, I had to... I went back in front of the judge, and they ended up telling me my terms of my probation. They gave me 2,000 hours community service. I had to carry pictures of the victims in my wallet. I had to place flowers on the grave sites for the next 10 years. I had to pay $10 a week to a memorial fund. I had to carry a sign on Westheimer where the accident happened that said I killed two people while driving drunk on Westheimer. And, you know, along with other conditions of probation.
That's a lot. Wow. What was your reaction to that sentence?
I guess at first I was angry, and then as like time went on, I started to understand why he gave me the structure and gave me the accountability I needed to succeed. And he was smart enough and understanding enough to take into account the whole situation. I deal a lot with judges today, and a lot of them, the easy solution is locking somebody up and saying, you know, go spend your time in jail and get out and commit and do the same thing versus mm-hmm. trying to rehabilitate somebody and get them to be a productive member of society.
So of all those things that he told you you had to do, which was the most difficult?
I think it's I guess the most difficult is the one you're actually doing, you know, and then when you're done, I guess some people perceive it as, oh, it's meant to be a constant reminder of what happened. It's like I constantly, even today, still remember, you know, what I did and what brought me here, the accident. I live every day of my life knowing that I took two other lives. You know, having to carry a sign or having to carry pictures on the wall, it doesn't make me remember even more, you know. Mm-hmm. I truly was remorseful. And some of it was just, you know, the sign carrying and stuff like that was more public awareness, you know.
Public awareness or public shaming? I mean, was the shame part of the punishment?
I understood, I guess, maybe that the fact that I was out there carrying the sign and doing some of that stuff, that hopefully would prevent somebody else from doing what I did. Mm. I don't know if it was really shameful in what I was doing, but more understanding that there was a purpose behind it.
How did people react when you were on the high side of the highway carrying your sign?
95% of the people were positive.
And that, really?
You know, they would say, God bless you, or, you know, it's, you know, this too shall pass type stuff.
So they didn't roll down their car windows and spit at you or yell at you or something?
No, but there was also plenty of police presence and security and stuff like that, that the judge and the probation department took my safety into consideration also. Mm-hmm. And if at any point they felt unsafe for me, they would have pulled me out of it.
I guess I was thinking that the parts that were the public parts, you know, the showing up at the graveyard and the carrying a sign in public, I guess I was thinking that it's a way of forcing somebody to really feel accountable for what they did. I mean, because we all have layers of defenses. I mean, just because you put somebody in a jail cell doesn't mean that they'll spend any time thinking about what they did, whereas it's a little hard to walk, you know, up and down past the accident site carrying a sign that says you killed somebody and not think about it. Do you know what I mean?
Most of the people that I've spoken with that have been in my position, it's something that it's a constant reminder for them. That if they look in the mirror, they know what happened. It's something you live the rest of your life doing. You know, I struggled with the idea with God. If I survived my accident as a, you know, a living purgatory, that the easier solution would have been to die. I felt like at times that the struggles I had in life and so on, da da da, were, you know, just God punished me for the actions I took. and that, you know, the easy solution would have been to die. And if I kept going and living and doing everything, then it was a harder solution. But in reality,
do you think that?
At times I did. I mean, it's something I've got out of through processing, through treatment and recovery. But I don't know if it's like survivor's guilt or what. But I struggled with a long time of why I lived and other people died. I had to understand and come to a belief that I lived for a reason, and that reason, you know, what was instilled in me by people around me and so on, was to be of service for others. And to share my message and to share the idea of, you know, people can recover.
Mike, thank you so much for sharing the grace with which you've dealt with all of this. Thanks. And thanks for, spending time with us.
Okay, no problem.
Mike Hubacek turned his life around after receiving a creative, shame-based sentence for killing two people while driving drunk. He now runs a halfway house called Sober Living in Houston. So maybe shame, painful as it is, has some value. Maybe it's not just an emotion, but a social tool. Jennifer Jaquette thinks that there is an upside to shame. She's an assistant professor in the Environmental Studies Department at New York University, and she's the author of a book called Is Shame Necessary? New Uses for an Old Tool. She talked with Steve Paulson about how to use shame for the power of good.
Jennifer, how did you get so interested in this whole question of shame?
I got interested for a few reasons. One was that I saw a lot of guilt and a lot of headlines that had to do with guilt, especially in the realm of the environment. So people were feeling very guilty about flying or even having a second child, things like that. And I thought of the way people were engaging with that guilt seemed to be often in terms of individual personal choices. And this to me seems sort of superfluous because that kind of engagement doesn't scale very well.
By scaling well, you wanted something, you were interested in something that would actually have a big impact.
Yeah, when you can make big changes quickly. And it seems like individual by individual is a much harder way to make a big difference quickly, unless you sort of sell consumer goods, right? Those definitely do scale. So I was curious on how we could, without necessarily involving governments or before government legislation came into play, because right now we are in the situation where government is failing us in many ways, how we could get these large changes quickly.
And basically your solution is to shame groups of people or even governments or big corporations when they're doing bad things?
Yeah, so it's not always the solution, of course, but I lay out in the book cases in which there's a clear path to shame. When, why, how. It's more in terms of using it as a stopgap before probably tougher legislation or some sort of global governance. But it can work at scale, and that was the kind of package research I did for this book.
So give me some examples of how this can work.
A nice example is Rainforest Action Network and a couple other nonprofits have been singling out big banks that are funding mountaintop removal. Basically, the coal companies actually that do the removal in Appalachia. And this is a really environmentally destructive practice, and these groups and many citizens want to put an end to it. So before they can get legislation put in place, and many people are working on that, these nonprofits are using public exposure on these banks, attacking their reputation year after year. Last year was the fifth year of the report, and two of the major nine banks that they target have last year decided to end ties with the coal companies.
So how does this work? I mean, how do you actually shame a corporation in public?
Well, I mean, you've seen this, right? You get negative headlines, you release reports, you have protests, you carry signs sometimes that say, shame on Wells Fargo or whoever it is you're interested in, and you attract the attention of the crowd. And this is very much sort of like the town square idea, but aimed at a much higher level.
And is this effective?
Well, as I just mentioned with the banks, two out of the nine have given it up. Now, Would we ideally like all nine? Yes. Is that their ultimate goal? Yes. Will legislation probably have to be put in place to achieve that? Yes. But in the meantime, these groups have shown that it's possible to get banks to change their behavior, and they've gotten them to set a good example. And there are lots of these kinds of examples in the book.
To some degree, you're talking about generating negative publicity, but you're going a step further. I mean, you're actually using this idea of shame. Sort of bringing, I guess, what we would call sort of moral opprobrium into trying to bring down some of these companies.
It's hard because you could just say, oh, you're exposing them or negative publicity, but sometimes that doesn't get really exactly to the heart of the matter. And what I am interested in with shame is that because it requires an audience and because that audience is essential to the effectiveness of shame and the intensity of it, I think problems that really affect that audience lend themselves more to public exposure. So it's kind of not just negative publicity because that only talks about that one side. Shame says, no, there's actually a big audience looking at that negative publicity as well. So in some cases, what I'm more interested in, I guess, is whether or not people change their behavior in light of the threat of public exposure and then audience interest in that.
And you've actually done some experiments on this, haven't you?
I have indeed. And in these experiments, we didn't ask students how they felt either, but we did threaten them with shame or promise them honor, but in a very gentle sort of way. They were playing a public goods game, which is a sort of cooperation experiment where they can give money to a public pool or not. And in our experiments, we told them at the very start of the game, hey, look, at the end of 10 rounds of this game, we're going to expose the least generous players, the two out of the six. And in the other treatment, the honor treatment, we said we're going to expose the two most generous players. And in both of those treatments, actually, we saw an increase in cooperation by about 50%.
Of course. I'm surprised it wasn't more like 100%.
Yeah, well, it's hard in these games because there's not a ton of movement, so even 50% is a lot because they have just a choice between 0 and 1 at each round. I don't even know if 100% increase was possible, in other words. But it was significant, to say the least. And I think when people hear this, they go, well, then why didn't you write a book about honor? You know, it's such a more positive and if it's just equally as powerful. But I then bring up the case of, you know, state taxes. So California and about 20 other states have now introduced shaming tax delinquents.
What do they do? So some of the biggest tax delinquents, they are named publicly?
They're told that within 6 months of receiving a letter that their name will be posted online as a tax delinquent. And they only expose the, often, depending on the state, but in California, the 500 worst tax delinquents, and you have to owe more than $100,000 in back taxes. So that really targets the most egregious, and it allows sort of the poorest offenders to remain anonymous.
And what's been the impact of that?
So they've gotten over $400 million
wow.
in back taxes since they introduced the program in 2007. It costs them only about $130,000 a year to run. And this is so interesting because it's outside the legal system, right? It's simply using the power of reputation. Now, the other interesting thing is it's the threat of shame that's more powerful than the shame itself. Most of the people pay up before they get on the list. That's the goal.
Now, you say that shaming can also be playful, artful even.
Those are the best forms of shaming.
Well, you write about this guy who used to be the mayor of Bogota, Colombia. Tell me
about amazing.
Him.
He's amazing. Yeah, Mayor Mocus. He knew both the art of shame and shamelessness because he wound up becoming mayor because he used to be president of the university. He was trying to get the crowd's attention one evening when they were being really rowdy. And to do that, he dropped his trousers and mooned the audience. So he becomes notorious and loses his job. But with that attention, he decides, you know, I'm going to run for mayor. And he wins. Cheapest election in Bogota history, apparently. And he used art and shaming so intertwined and so creatively during his time. I'll just give you one example, the one he's most famous for. He hired handfuls of mimes to follow people around the city and point out bad pedestrian and driving behavior because there were high amounts of fatalities due to car accidents and pedestrian collisions. Then they were so popular and so well understood and embraced by the public, he hired 400 more. And he was actually able to show that these mimes led to a decrease in fatalities. And it was such a great use of sort of street theater and shaming and getting people to self-regulate. He was really interested in the culture of self-regulation.
What did these mimes do? How did they shame people, the bad drivers?
Well, I've never seen footage of it. I've only seen photographs, but it seems that they held up signs. They would follow around pedestrians, follow them closely in a mocking or ridiculing way if they crossed at the wrong time. They would point out drivers that weren't wearing their seatbelts. They would also get really active, apparently, if there was excessive honking. So they were just kind of our conscience, but expressed in this street theater, which was just so cool.
And these mimes were actually on the public payroll?
Yeah, they were paid by the city. I think it's a great use of public funds. You fund the arts and a decrease in traffic accidents at the same time.
Jennifer Jackwood is the author of Is Shame Necessary? New Uses for an Old Tool. She talked with Steve Paulson. That's it for our conversation about shaming. But coming up, a dangerous idea and one woman's midlife quest for more sexual passion and adventure. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, my name is Mary Kay Zaravlev. I am a novelist who treasures creativity as much as insight, and my work has been described as exuberant, wildly inventive, and smart, which may explain why my dangerous idea is universal recess. Everyone needs to play, whether roughhousing or moving chess pieces around the board, from tantruming toddlers to Nobel-winning mathematicians to the dawdling elderly. Every single person needs the imagination, stimulation, and release that comes with play. In fact, play calms tantrums, leads mathematicians to discovery, and keeps aging at bay. 100 years ago, the legendary athlete Jim Thorpe challenged himself to make the same moves as a 2-year-old, but he only lasted a few hours before the toddler wore the Olympian out. Early on, we may eat to live, but toddlers live to play. Even eating is playing to them. Compare Thorpe's experience to a recent report from veteran teacher Alexis Wiggins. She shadowed high schoolers for 2 days and was exhausted by sitting still. She wondered how they managed to learn anything. "I could not stop yawning," it said in her report. Students move almost never, and never is exhausting. Who is responsible for treating recess like a rare dessert, that special privilege you have to earn and the first thing cut from the menu? We would do better to think of recess as water. 8 glasses a day. There should be a recommended minimum daily amount of unsupervised play. Despite preaching the importance of physical activities, schools still isolate the rabble-rouser student in detention. Universal recess will stipulate that we never take recess away, any more than you would discipline an overheated person by making him go without water. Sitting is the new smoking, and yet the biggest advance in office design is standing. Standing desks, as if standing 9 to 5 is such an improvement. Innovative companies offer yoga classes, trivia contests, ping pong tables, and bikes by the hour to benefit themselves as much as their employees. Recess improves people's motivation, concentration, and moods. Playing helps people solve problems or take a break from them. And you want to inspire teamwork, for heaven's sake, start a team, whether it's Scrabble or Ultimate Frisbee. Universal recess, I tell you. Want to improve your mental and physical health? Go to recess every day, rain or shine, with friends or strangers. Follow the rules or make up some new ones and enjoy the resuscitating properties of universal recess. Let's train each other to identify those who are failing to thrive and teach them the life-saving drill. Stop, drop, and play.
Mary Kay Zaravlev with her dangerous idea. She's the author of the novels Man Alive and The Bowl Is Already Broken. A couple of years ago, Robin Rinaldi placed an eye-opening ad on her local Craigslist.
Good girl seeks experience. I'm a 44-year-old professional, educated, attractive woman in an open marriage, seeking single men aged 35 to 50 to help me explore my sexuality. You must be trustworthy, smart, and skilled at conversation as well as in bed. We will first meet in public for coffee or a drink. If that goes well, we'll have dinner, possibly followed by sex.
Robin Rinaldi was midlife, mid-career, and mid-marriage when she placed that ad, and it launched her Wild Oats Project, a whole year spent exploring sex. I know this is not the kind of thing you expect to hear on public radio, but I was thinking, we've been talking about shame in this hour. And Robin's experiment was all about breaking free of shame and constraint. She tells the story of her wild year in a new memoir. And Robin, I guess our first challenge is figuring out how to talk about this on the radio. Has this been hard?
It's very hard, honestly. Listen, it's, you know, it was hard to live it and it was hard to write it, but I never expected how vulnerable I would feel just talking about it out loud. Like the page feels like a sacred space, you mm-hmm. know, just me and the reader. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all this media speaking out loud is much more difficult.
I think it would be incredibly hard. And I mean, as an interviewer reading your book, you know, I'm sort of most of the way through thinking, oh, my God, how the hell are we going to talk? I can't talk about that. No, I don't think
right.
we can talk about that either.
I've been keeping it PG rated. Don't worry.
That's good. So, Robin, can we begin with you moving out during the week and placing an ad for hookups in Craigslist?
Well, what was going on was what I think of now as the perfect storm. I was hitting midlife. I had a latent maternal urge that kind of surfaced and got very strong in my late 30s. My husband and I talked for years about this, and I tried to convince him that we should start a family. And we hit a crisis in my early 40s where I actually thought I was pregnant, although I wasn't. And he decided to get a vasectomy. And right then I realized I was never going to have children and I was going to go to my deathbed with no children, but also with, you know, four lovers to my name, including him. And something in me, something very female and body-centered in me, just refused to go to my grave that way. And so I said to myself, I said to him, I can give up one of those things. I can give up sexual abandon and liberation for a family, or I can give up having the family, but I have to have one.
So how did your husband feel about this when you told him you wanted an open marriage? What did he say?
Well, he didn't want to. He had his wild youth over with quite a long time ago. His youth was different than mine. Mine was cautious and straight and narrow, and, you know, his was more typical male. And he felt, you know, things couldn't really go on the way they were. We were in a marital crisis, so we might as well do it and see if we could weather it and what it could teach us.
Was there a politics to this for you? Because, you know, I'm thinking we live in a hyper-sexualized culture where sex sells everything from toothpaste to the Super Bowl. But at the same time, we idealize monogamy. So we're surrounded by all of these sexy images, but we're supposed to be faithful to one partner for life. I mean, what do you make of that dichotomy?
Well, that's just one of the crazy dichotomies we live with. Men and women live with every day, right? But it was not political for me. In fact, the feminist in me was actually arguing with it on many levels.
How so? And what was the feminist in you saying?
Oh, she was saying, why do you think motherhood and sex are the only two routes to true womanhood? Isn't that the Madonna whore problem? That's what she was saying. And I had to say, okay, I love you, I'm a feminist, but please be quiet for a while because my body wants something and I'm going to get it.
Well, and it turns out San Francisco had an entire community of people in open relationships, and you found your way to, what would you call it, an urban sex commune?
Yeah, they called it an urban commune. Sex commune is a little much
misleading.
Because it wasn't quite what you picture from the 60s and 70s with everybody like having sex when you walk in the door. It was more like a sexual education center. It was called One Taste, and they focus on female sexuality because there aren't a lot of places in the world, or even sometimes in heterosexual relationships, where you can just stop and focus on the woman and her response, which I found fascinating.
Mm. Will you tell me about one or two of your lovers, the men you met, and what were they like?
I mean, for the most part, they were just kind of, you know, normal people, maybe people I wouldn't have met in my normal, you know, walk of life, being like a busy magazine editor. There was like an astrologer who was very ethereal. There were other men who were working on PhDs in Eastern philosophy, and there were a lawyer and a chef. I mean, they were just kind of men from all walks of life and a couple women from all walks of life. But one thing sex does is it connects people very deeply. If you stay aware of what's happening during sex, you really see another person's beauty. Even if it's fleeting, when you're up that close to another human being, you really see how vulnerable and beautiful human beings are. In a way, I mean, I had many moments of what I call spiritual feelings about humanity, basically.
What changed in you? I mean, I'm curious about your relationship with your body, the way you think about pleasure, even your sense of self.
A lot changed, but I have this feeling after doing this and writing about it that sex is an area for women that is extremely powerful. It's extremely full of female, feminine power. But we have been taught that it's where we have to be super careful, and we sometimes get small mentally or physically. And there is a deep fear of women's pleasure in particular, and especially women's pleasure and power in sex. I think it's a taboo, actually.
There are places in the world where a woman doing what you did would risk being beaten or stoned.
Killed. Yeah, I mean, that's in my book, too. So I'm off in San Francisco. I'm a very privileged, very lucky white American woman, quote unquote, exploring my sexuality. And I'd be walking into a class or going somewhere to meet a friend or a lover, and I would actually stop and feel in my stomach. There's some woman right now, halfway across the world, if she were doing this, she would be risking her life. That just shows you that even though women here and there can do this kind of thing, it's still going to touch off a very deep chord.
So in the meantime, you were doing this during the week and then going home to your husband on the weekend. I have to say, reading this, a lot of the time, my sympathy was with your husband. I mean, I don't think I could do what he did. And in the end, you know, you two did wind up splitting after all of this. Do you feel like your experiment destroyed your marriage?
Yes, I think the marriage was slowly ending before the experiment. And yes, I think it was the final straw. And I have to say, it's very hard to write about your own marriage. There's a tendency to want to really complain about the other person so that people, you know, empathize with you. And I didn't want to do that. I tended to blame myself more.
I didn't mean that I was judging you. I just meant that marriages are complicated.
Yes, usually they are.
You can't judge one or the other. And reading it, I both understood what you were doing and why, and partly wanted to cheer you on, and partly felt terrible for your husband.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, me too.
Yeah.
You know, I felt the exact same way. I think sometimes there's things that happen in our lives, things we feel we need to do. Our soul is telling us to do them, even though we know there's going to be pain and messiness involved. And this was one of those things. I made a mental count, 12 new lovers in the past year. Some had become close friends. Most had helped me befriend parts of myself that had been lying in wait. From what I gathered, Sex wasn't the only route to this kind of self-discovery. I probably could have taken up painting or traveled the world, or sat in silent contemplation and ultimately discovered the same lost facets of myself. But I will say one thing about self-knowledge gained through sex. When you're pressed for time, it's efficient and sure. It lands in the body, and the body remembers.
Robin Rinaldi. Her memoir is called The Wild Oats Project, One Woman's Midlife Quest for Passion at Any Cost. That's it for this hour, but there is more in our podcast feed. If you haven't already, we'd love it if you'd subscribe. That way you'll never miss another hour, and you'll help us grow our podcast audience. Just search for To the Best of Our Knowledge on your favorite podcast app, like iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're feeling generous, leave a comment. That helps other people find the show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Oh, also special thanks to audio engineer Joe Hartke for all his help this week. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks to you for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.